Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Hope everyone's doing okay. Folks are still signing on here. And we are continuing once again with our journey through Mishnah Pesachim. We are in the second chapter. There was a little bit of a connection challenge yesterday, and I hope I'm not going to have that again today. If so, I may have to move again, and then we may buy a new modem over the weekend and figure all of that stuff out, but we'll see. So in any event, last time, just very brief recap, we went through three different Mishnayot, one that we did, actually four. We reviewed the Chametz Shel Nochri and the different ownership questions and who owns what on Pesach, and then the question of whether a loan actually puts us in a place of having transferred something over, buildings collapsing, whether dogs can find things, various applications of the worthlessness of chametz to eating truma of chametz that belongs to priests, unintentionally, intentionally. And then we finally got into beginning to delineate what are the things that are valid in terms of being grains and the various states that they can and cannot be in to still be valid, to fulfill the obligation to eat matzah. So Mishnah Hey, that last Mishnah was all about the five kinds of species of grain that are valid for making matzah, and then all these different categories of demai and ma'aser rishon and ma'aser sheni and tevel. And essentially the rule that emerged from there is that something that is kind of completely and totally forbidden and off limits or completely dedicated to the sanctuary in some way is not valid for matzah. Whereas things that are in a sort of doubtful or interstitial space in one way or another are basically able to function as fulfilling that obligation. So we're going to move forward now where we're going to see the application of this now beyond matzah, but to maror. But you're going to see that a lot of the categories are going to be very similar. So we're up here on the screen with the next Mishnah, Mishnah number 6, which we're going to continue with. Ve'elu yirakot she'adam yotzeva hen yedei chovato befesach, b'chazeret uve'ulushin, uve'tamcha, uve'charchavina, uve'maror. All right, so here too, we get five things. We get five things here that we say that we are able to use for as vegetables to fulfill our obligations on Pesach. Okay, so that is essentially, right, the entire, yes, great, thanks for sending out the link for folks who want to follow directly. The vegetables here are translated in various ways below. Some of them we feel pretty clear about. I would say others are a matter of dispute. So chazeret, the first one, that's definitely romaine lettuce. That's the first in the list. That's the one that they seem to have used. That's the one that most people today use when they're trying to do something that's faithful to what the Mishnah would have done. And it was pretty much used uninterruptedly in lands that had access to lettuce, that is to say places that were closer to the equator before our current supply chains developed and played out. Ulshin is often defined as endive. Here you have a translation of chicory. Tamcha here they translate as wild chicory, but tamcha was the term in the Mishnah that European Jews used to refer to horseradish. So even though historically it seems pretty clear that horseradish was something that Europeans only adopted because they had no access to anything else. And they just said, well, what do we have around here that can in some way qualify as bitter? We'll take this root vegetable. And there was a strong drive to claim, yeah, maybe that's that tamcha in the Mishnah, that who really knows what it is. As many people have pointed out, horseradish doesn't really fit the description of what maror is supposed to do. Specifically the Midrash that talks about how the maror starts out sweet and ends up bitter, which is a good description of romaine lettuce, where at first you get a certain kind of sweeter, juicier taste in your mouth, and then there's a slight bitter aftertaste. The idea that that's how the Egyptians dealt with us. It was at first a great place to live, and then it became terrible. So tamcha doesn't really fit that if it's horseradish, because it's just pungent, intense. I'm not sure we would even call it bitter. And then we've got these other picridium and sanchus, these various other plants that we're not necessarily so sure exactly what they are. You see, one of the things that's valid for maror was actually a plant that they called maror. Okay, so the yotzei yedei chovato here, the fulfilling one's obligation, is all about what vegetables can you use to fulfill your obligation to eat maror at the Seder. All right. So since the Torah says al matzot u'morim yochluhu, eat the korban Pesach with matzah and maror, there was understood to be an obligation to eat maror at the night of the Seder, even if there was no korban Pesach, even if there was no Pesach sacrifice. Interesting debates in the Talmud. The general assumption is that maror without the sacrifice is only a derabanan, only a rabbinic level obligation, because the Torah never tells us to eat maror independent of talking about eating the korban Pesach. Whereas matzah was understood by many to retain its biblical level obligation, because there are all kinds of verses that say, Barishon ba'arba'as yom lachodesh ba'erev tochlu matzot. On the night of the 14th, the night following the 14th, you should eat matzah, which is a verse that is in no way referring at that moment to the sacrifice that normally would have accompanied it. In any event, maror remains an obligation, and it needs to be fulfilled. It's its own part in the Seder, and these are the things that are valid for it. And now we get some further specifications. Yotzin bahem bein lachin bein yeveshin, aval lo chushin velo shlukin velo mevushalin. You can fulfill your obligation in maror with them, whether they are still moist or whether they have dried out. But if they have been pickled or stewed or boiled, then they are no longer valid. So there's some notion of it needs to be sort of in its basically original form, albeit it can be dried, the same way, you know, we deal with spices, where you can have a fresh spice or a dried spice, but you still consider that to be using that spice in your recipe, as it were. But once you start pickling or boiling things, you have either kind of numbed its taste or replaced it with something else, and that is no longer an okay way to use it. And they can all combine to the size of an olive, meaning the Mishnah assumes the amount of maror that I need to eat is an amount that is a significant act of eating, which in the Mishnah's world is always a kazait, an olive's worth. A common sense olive worth would be about that, something like that. Various things happen in the history of halakha where all kinds of different positions emerge. People worried maybe their olives were bigger than ours, and maybe they're comparing them to eggs, and our eggs, their eggs were bigger than ours, and all kinds of things that can lead you with people starting to talk about a kazait, you know, being as big as this. The common sense measure here is something that, you know, you put in your mouth, you feel like I did actually just eat something. V'yotzin bakelach shelahen. And you can fulfill your obligation by eating their stalk. Meaning, if you think about romaine lettuce, you don't have to eat only the green part at the end. You can fulfill your obligation by eating the white part of the stalk. Uvidmai, uvemaaser rishon shenitla trumato, uvemaaser sheni vehekdesh shenifdu. And like these categories we encountered in the first Mishnah, similarly, if the vegetable that you use has the status of dmai, meaning it came from an am haaretz or an eino ne'eman, someone who is not trustworthy with respect to tithing, and therefore you would normally be strict and take the tithe. Nonetheless, if you ate that kind of produce for maror, you have fulfilled your obligation. And similarly, ma'aser rishon, something that belongs to the Levi, to the Levite, but that had its trumat ma'aser, its added portion for the priest, properly removed, that's perfectly fine food to eat. And ma'aser sheni and hekdesh, things that are either designated to be eaten as a tithe in Jerusalem or have been consecrated to the temple, as long as they've been redeemed and they've been actually taken out of that state, then it is perfectly fine. They have no problematic status. A few comments here about horseradish, usually including some vinegar, and does that make it pickled? And indeed, the notion of eating some horseradish that is just straight, right? Which is to say, either we used to have at my Seder table actually sticks of horseradish, or just the grated up chazeret, and taking some of that and adding that to the charoset, which we'll get to in a minute, but not necessarily having the pickled kind. That is, one of the things that dances around this practice. Again, the horseradish is itself a kind of departure from what the original vegetables were here. But to the extent one was going to fulfill one's obligation with horseradish, yes, it would be better to eat some of it raw. Now, the kezayit piece gets in the way here, where you have any number of poskim over the generations who say, but if you actually ate a kezayit, an olive's worth of pure, unadulterated maror, you know, that could kill you, or that would be so painful it would be unbearable. And there were attempts at arguments that, well, kezayit is only to give you the amount that it would require to have some bite. And if you have something that's more spicy, perhaps you can get away with even less than a kezayit. I recommend avoiding all of these things. And even if you maintain an ancestral tradition of also having some horseradish, or maybe having it on your korech, on your sandwich, I recommend having a piece of romaine lettuce, which is definitely the way it used to be done, resonates with all the midrashim about it, and you can definitely eat a kezayit, an olive's worth, without any problem. Just looking here also, one other thing, what's our obligation? Are we looking to experience a specific taste where the Jews have historically tasted? Yeah, these are all good questions. I mean, this really relates, I think, to the question of how much we are in a tradition that sort of plays out over time in history, and how much we are trying to basically capture some original meaning. With things like this, I'm definitely always a sucker to a little bit of the originalist stuff, but I also am not for completely wiping out pathways that have been taken. So usually what I do is I have romaine lettuce at the Seder for my maror, but then I definitely eat some horseradish at some other point, whether it's at the korech part or it's at the gefilte fish course or some other time. And that's always, I think, an interesting thing to kind of balance. Why would you think that Maaser Rishon, which had its Trumat Maaser taken, would not be okay? Yeah, great question. That's the question the Gemara asks repeatedly. This is an example. So the question is just saying this phrase, the tithe for the Levi, the tithe given to the Levite that has had its Truma taken out of it, why would you think there is anything problematic about that? Isn't that just regular food that's not forbidden to everyone? So this is the kind of thing where the Talmud will actually say, yeah, you know what? The Mishnah didn't really need to teach that. But why did it teach it? Because it has the parallel case, like it did in the previous Mishnah, where it wants to tell you, Ma'aser Rishon Shelo Nitla Trumato. It wants to be clear that the tithe that goes to the Levi that didn't have that added piece for the priest taken out is not okay. And that sometimes the Mishnah adds in sort of parallel phrases that have no added meaning to them in order to give it a certain kind of literary balance. And it's a reflection of the ways in which this was originally an oral text and designed to be memorized, such that certain repeating patterns of certain phrases and remembering, I just said A, so I have to remember to say not A in the next phrase, are hardwired into a lot of the Mishnah's content. Great. Let's move on to Mishnah Zayin. So now we're going to actually talk about how do you produce chametz, meaning what are the processes that you may not even be thinking about that might render some kind of leavening that you have to be worried about on Pesach. So here we're now on Pesach. We've already been discussing what you can fulfill your obligation with at the Seder. And we're talking about other places where flour, basically, and other grain materials may feature in your life. Ein shorin et hamursan latarnegolim aval choltim. So you're preparing a mash, basically, for your chickens. you need to feed them something. And one of the things that would be fed to them was a mix of bran and water. And the normal thing you would do is you would not just feed them the bran, they need it in some kind of liquid softener substance. So you'd dump some bran into some water and let it soak, and then the chickens would go and eat that and get some sustenance and nutrients. Well, you can't do that because by putting the mursan, the bran of the grain, into water on Pesach, you're creating chametz, you're creating something that's going to begin to ferment. So what are you allowed to do? You're allowed to do chalita. You are allowed to have a boiling pot of water or whatever it is. And while it's on the fire, drop the bran in. And the idea is the bran will then get cooked basically immediately. It will not go through a process of fermenting. It will go through a process of kind of scalding, sealing. And the idea is that if you subject something to chalita, what they're calling here scalding, but it's really almost like, parboiling, blanching, right? Like when you blanch a tomato, something like that. If you blanch something in that way in boiling water, then actually you freeze the chametz process, all right? And then it can sit in that water and nothing will happen. It'll be no different than something like a matzah ball, sitting in water when it's made of matzah flour that was already cooked and sort of the chametz process was stopped off. This can, in theory, do that as well. Hayisha lo tishre et hamursan shetolich biyadah lamerchatz, aval shafahi bivsara yavesh. A woman should not soak bran to take with her to the bathhouse, but she can rub it on her skin. Okay, so this is one of the many places where ha'isha, the term a woman, is used in the Mishnah, not because this halacha is actually gendered in any way, but just because we are getting a scene from life. And the scene from life is that the woman has some kind of primary responsibility in the kitchen and with respect to the mursan, to this bran. And we are worried about a scene where she's the one who will potentially take some soaking bran and bring it with her to the merchatz. The sense here seems to be a bathhouse where, think of an exfoliant, okay? Instead of like an exfoliant of a soap, you would use bran soaked in some water as an astringent surface to get dirt off your body when you were going to bathe. And this is something that apparently when women went to the merchatz, they would do. But you are allowed to use the bran as a kind of exfoliant in its dry form. All right, so on Pesach, basically, we see here how the bathing procedures of people also have to change, lest they are going to create some kind of chametz with the mixing between the bran and the water. And then finally, another example, lo yil'os adam chitin ve'aniach al makato b'fesach b'pnei she'en machmitzot. Another thing that people seem to have done informally as a sort of medical cure all the time was if you had some kind of bruise, the way we put a Band-Aid or ointments, people would take grains of wheat, chew them up, and basically then shove them on their wound. All right, I have no idea what the epidemiologists would say about this, but this was clearly a common remedy or some kind of soothing salve type activity. You can't do that on Pesach. You can't use wheat because it will turn into chametz, that is to say, it will begin to ferment. So this is also important. It reminds us, and people familiar with Pesach practice until today know this to be the case. It's not as if the only place we're worried about generating chametz is in things that we are going to eat, right? It's also things that we own, even things that are not necessarily food, even though it does have to be something that is still appropriate to eat or possible to eat. Right, there's a sort of almost extreme, bizarre case in the Gemara. They talk about, well, what if you made a chair out of chametz? Okay, and the idea there is that, oh, then it's a chair. It's no longer food, and so it doesn't matter anymore because it doesn't have some human function. So there are some limits on that. People raise those kinds of questions around, like if you have Play-Doh that's made out of flour, are you allowed to keep that and have your kids play with that over Pesach? And one very solid opinion says that's like turning chametz into a share, meaning no one's going to ever eat the Play-Doh anymore. Even if it would be possible for a dog to eat it, it's been given a totally different function. But these cases are not that way. These are things where something you would recognize as chametz, and certainly a dog could eat, and it's not like they've really been set aside for some other function. You have to avoid them getting wet. A couple questions here about gebrocht, those who are worried about getting any kind of water and even pieces of matzah, being nervous about this. So let's be clear, right? Gebrocht is the practice of saying even once matzah has been baked, you may not get it wet. This is much more radical than that. So even potentially people who eat gebrocht might be nervous about boiling flour in water. This is flour that has not yet been baked or roasted or prepared in any way. And indeed, the leniency of chalita, the leniency of submerging flour in boiling water, pretty much falls away and disappears because people get nervous about, well, is it hot enough? How do you know? Like in some theoretical world, under the regime of chalita, you could make gnocchi. Right, you could actually have a flour paste that you quickly mixed up, and you know, before 18 minutes happened, you drop it into the boiling water, and that's it. It didn't rise. That already gets rolled back, starts to get rolled back in the Gaonic period, in the post Talmudic period, because of nervousness, even before you get to the level of gebrocht, of are we really actually stopping the process of fermentation? Okay, let's go. A little more here, just to see a few more examples from life, and this will get us to the end of the second parak, which is where we'll end today. Ein notnin kemach letoch hacharoset o letoch hachardal ve'im natan yochal miyad ve'Rabbi Meir oser. You should not put flour into charoset or into chardal, into mustard, and if you did do that, you must eat it immediately. And Rabbi Meir forbids. Okay, so what are we saying here? We're saying here, in theory, you could have charoset. And you could say, I want to thicken this up with a little bit of flour. And I'm going to eat it, you know, right away. Right? Like, I'm not going to just let it sit in there. I might even acknowledge that kemach, flour, is going to present a problem. If I put it in charoset, there's some liquid in there. It will create some fermentation. But my plan is to mix it in and to just immediately eat it on the spot. So the Mishnah says, don't do that, okay? Do not put it into charoset or into mustard. And if you did it, yes, you better eat it right away because, let's say, by the time 18 minutes pass, it will be chametz. All right, but the Mishnah does not want you to do that, even though it acknowledges it will not become chametz right away. Rabbi Meir, however, says it is actually forbidden right away off the bat. And here we get the notion, most of us are familiar with the idea that 18 minutes is the amount of time that when you put flour in water, it creates some kind of chametz situation. But there is an idea that comes up with various food combinations that maybe there are some things that are machmitzin miyad, that there's something about this is already a fermenty type food, either charoset or chardal, charoset or mustard, and it will trigger that process basically instantaneously. Rabbi Meir seems to have been of that view, and therefore if you put the kemach, the flour, in either of those things, you just got to get rid of it right away. Few people excited about mustard on Pesach, yes. That has not yet been fingered as any kind of problem by the Mishnah and only gets caught up in the dragnet of kitniot and legumes and other things later on. Ein mivashlin et ha-pesach, lo v'mashkin, ve'lo v'mei perot, aval sachin u'matbilin otovahem. When you are cooking the korban pesach, the meat that you're roasting, okay, you are not allowed to boil it, all right? That already the Torah says, right? But it says, uvashel mivushal bamaim. It says you cannot boil it in water. The Mishnah is closing down the possibility that you would say, oh, you can't boil it in water, but you could boil it in apple juice. You could boil it in wine. No, you cannot cook the Pesach in a liquid medium. no matter what that is, no kind of liquid, no kind of fruit juice. However, once you have roasted it over the fire, you are allowed to actually baste it and dip it in them. Okay, so it's not as if you can have no exposure to liquid of the Korban Pesach and it must be completely dry, but its mode of cooking must be over the fire and it must be being cooked by the fire, even though these liquids could ultimately play a part in your consumption. And the last line, Mei tashmisho shel nachtom yishafchu mipnei shehein machmitzin. The water of the baker must be spilled out because they become chametz, they begin fermenting. Now, this is a sort of, you know, not as imaginable scene for us today with the way, most of the way that Pesach food preparation is structured. The assumption is, oh, well, everything, the only thing you're gonna bake on Pesach is matzah. And we bake all the matzah in advance and people just buy all of their matzah and they're done. And even if they buy it during Pesach, a backup box, it's been prepared beforehand. But that was obviously not the way it was done. There was baking throughout Pesach. Yes, you were baking matzah and you would do that every day and you didn't have it wrapped up in plastic wrapped and sealed boxes. The nachtom, the baker, was busy on Pesach. And the question is, how do you deal with the water and the flour when you are making things? And so the idea here is that, as opposed to the rest of the year, where you just have a bowl of water that's sitting around and you periodically take some of it and put your hands in and take some flour and start making a dough out of it, here you will have to spill out any of the remaining water that you are using in any shift of baking, because it will get trace amounts of flour in it and it will become chametz. The Talmud makes clear that when we say yishafchu, pour it out, you actually have to pour it out on a midron, on some kind of slope, which is to say, that's a way of saying you have to make sure it doesn't collect in one place. Because since it's on Pesach, the concern is not just eating it, but also owning it. And so you should not have an amount of chametz, the amount of a kezayit, of an olive's worth, gathered in any one place. So even if you had like a pool on your floor of a little bit of water with some of that flour that was in it, that would be a problem to have around and to be able to do that. Mipnei she'en machmitzin. Because they're going to be chametz. Okay, so we have a couple of questions here. I want to just go back to them before we have to wrap. Someone asked, how can you keep the bran or the flour for doing chalita for this boiling thing, given lo yera'e, given that you're not allowed to own it? So again, putting aside which contemporary flours may already have been treated with water, in their process of preparation, right? There are many contemporary flours that you buy that actually have already had some kind of pre-treating, and therefore there's a concern that they're really chametz. Flour on its own is not chametz. You don't have to get rid of flour in principle. If you bought a bunch of wheat and ground it up before Pesach, you're allowed to keep that through Pesach. How else would you bake matzah? You need something like that. So the bran is around, the flour is around. The presumption is it's been kept dry. These Mishnayot are about saying, let's make sure we don't get it wet and we don't make it chametz. Another question here, for baking matzah, don't you need water that sat overnight? So you do potentially need water that sat overnight, though it's not clear if the Mishnah already is signed on to that requirement. That becomes clear later in the Talmud. So there could be a historical gap here, but even assuming this last piece is consistent with that, which is saying you might have taken some special water that sat overnight, which is grounded in some notion of keeping it away from any source of heat, anything either from subterranean heat while it's still in the ground, or, you know, having sat out all day in the sun, you kind of draw it late in the day when everything has cooled off, keep it out overnight, and store it inside. Even if you do that, the question is, okay, but can you leave that water kind of between batches of cooking. And the idea here is the mei tashmisho, any water that you actively used in preparing one loaf or one batch, that's got to be one and done in terms of moving on from that point. That's where we are. Yasher koach, great job. We have finished off the second perek. Hope to see you tomorrow.